Succession number 28464, Reel 3.
John Harris, Reel 3. John, you were saying you were training in the armoured car.
Yes, that's right. Training. We were training the armoured cars. I was a couple of miles out in Yorkshire, and then that spring, when it warmed up a bit, we moved down into Gloucestershire, to the small town of Wootton Underage. There we simply went on training, and I got moved to my regimental headquarters to help train a lot of recruits we'd had who'd never been taught to drive. Quite a frightening experience, but we had some success.
Can you say what the training involved?
Well, that what I was actually doing there was that of a driving instructor.
Oh, really?
You had to be able to do anything. And these boats were no use to us if they couldn't either drive an armoured car or a wheeled vehicle of some sort, or work a radio, or fire a machine gun, or later on to command an armoured car or a tank. You see, there was very little scope for the employment of people who didn't have some special qualifications. That was essential in all armoured warfare. However, we weren't long at Wootton Underage, and we then moved down into Surrey, in the area of Charwood. I remember an amusing incident there. The War Office decided that they would change the establishment, that's the number of various categories of soldier, for an armoured car regiment from having 3 squadrons to having 4 squadrons. And we had a wily old commanding officer then, James Brown, and I was made assistant adjutant. And Brown assembled the adjutant myself and another member of the headquarters staff one day and said, we've got to turn 3 squadrons into 4, and then we shall get recruits who will be divided between the squadrons to make up the numbers. How do you think we should set about turning 3 squadrons into 4? So we said, well, I suppose they'll all have to give up a certain number of trained people, and we shall specialise the rank in which they should be, and we shall get 1/4 from each of the existing 3 squadrons, so that we should have 4 squadrons, each of 3/4 strength. He said, well, if we did that, all they'll do is they'll send us the least desirable of their existing the strengths. So we said, well, what should we do, Colonel? He said, I'll tell you what we should do. We should tell each of the squadrons to divide their existing personnel into 4 quarters. They have to include a certain number of sergeants and troopers and corporals and so on. But they'll divide them into 4 quarters, and I shall then pick which quarter they surrender out of a hat. That means they will divide as best they can into their existing squadrons into equal quarters, so that whichever I choose by putting that thing out of the hat will have the same as any other, which they did. So we formed an E squadron of the 3 quarters, and then we had some recruits, and I was made a captain and became my first officer promotion, second in command to the new D squadron. That all happened when we were here in the home counties in Surrey. We stayed for a time in Surrey. Not very much happened there. We then moved from Maresfield Camp which is in Sussex.
Was your wife moving round with you, or was she still in Yorkshire?
My wife was with me in Wootton, but not thereafter for some time. She had a job teaching at a boys' school at Colwell in near Malvern in Worcestershire, and that had helped her. She only followed me round in the school holidays. When we got to Maresfield, we're now in 1942, and there was talk of an overseas posting then, and we even had an inspection by a senior general who suggested certain changes in our senior officers. He thought one or two of our officers were rather elderly to go overseas. So the dear old farmer, Tom Pearson from Derbyshire, who had been my squadron leader, he stepped down from being in a fighting squadron, a sabre squadron, as the cavalry called it, to running headquarters, which is really an administrative squadron. The adjutant took over as commanding Tom Pearson's old B squadron, and I became adjutant. The adjutant is, for anyone listening who's not familiar with military titles, the adjutant is really the ADC to the colonel. He represents his opinion and communicates it and sees that it's followed by the squadron, the Sabre squadron leaders. Yes, and we had a visit then, the first visit from General Montgomery. And he suggested that our commanding officer, James Brown, really was too old for the job. I wouldn't have agreed to that, but that's what he thought. And we were unlucky. We had a very able second in command, John Cairns of the Royal Tank Regiment. He was claimed by his own tank corps regiment to command it, the 40th Tanks. And we were left without a commanding officer and without a second in command, and the talk was going abroad. That, I assumed, couldn't avoid a considerable additional responsibility. And then, later that year, we're into the end of 41, beginning of 42, the new commanding officer, Lord Allenby, arrived with a new second-in-command, Major Peter Wiggin, both from the regular cavalry regiment, the 11th Hussars. And they were just settling in May 1942, when it was announced that we were to leave England by a troop ship. We were still at Maresfield Camp in Sussex, and we got on trains from Crowborough Station in Sussex and were taken direct to the Clyde, going through the middle of London on the Bakerloo line. And there we got on two ships. We did not know where we were going. We got on two ships, peacetime liners. I was on a ship called the Strathnava, a P&O liner, in which my father had travelled to India on business between the wars several times. The other ship I didn't know much about, called the Monarch of Bermuda. And we left the Clyde on the 7th of May. And I should think that a minimum of 4 out of 5 of the people on those troop ships had ever been out of England before, because, of course, we were before the days of overseas holidays. We were packed very tight, but we were to no worse coming home, and the journey was uneventful. We stood off quietly at Freetown, but we didn't go aboard. I remember going up on deck at night and see them now, the majestic destroyers guarding a very large convoy. On the Strathnova, there was half our regiment and the whole of a nursing hospital. So we had female company, and quite a lot of fun was had all round. We stopped in Cape Town for 4 days. Got members, the officers got men.
Was that the first stop you made?
Hmm?
Was that the first stop you made?
Yes, 4 days in Cape
Town. Did you know you were heading for Cape Town?
Oh, yes. You see, you couldn't go through the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean was dominated by the Germans.
When was it you found out where you were going?
Ah, yes. About 3 days out, we were told we were bound for Port Suez, and we were going to the Middle East, in other words. And we would call it Cape Town. Some of the ships called it Durban. You stopped for a break, either Durban or Cape Town. And of course, the hospitality of the South Africans was out of this world. We landed at Suez on the 5th of July, so almost exactly 2 months, less than 4 days stop. It had taken us to go sail around the Cape. It would have taken a fortnight through the Mediterranean. And we were at Port Suez, put on in cattle trucks on the Egyptian railways, and taken to the Nile Delta. As we went there, the smoke was said to be rising from Cairo, as the British Embassy burnt its secret papers, because Rommel was at the gates of Alexandria at Alamein, where 3 historic battles were to be fought. In the particular spot in the desert we were there, under canvas, everyone suffered from what's called drippy tummy, and they got over that. And the main thing we learned there was something about how to find your way about in the desert. Because the desert was comparable to a sea. There were no roads, no signposts, except just on the coastal strip of Tripolitanian and Cyrenaica, and the strip along the Mediterranean, except just there. There was nothing growing at all, and it was very difficult to find a way about. We all had compasses. All ranks had a compass or access to one, but if you were in an armour car or a tank, the metal upset the compass, and the only way in which you could use the compass was to get out, stand in front of your vehicle, and take what was called a back bearing, and that could be converted into a forward bearing. That was a very lengthy, awkward business.
And dangerous, I should think.
Otherwise, you had to find your way by day by use of the sun compass. Now, the sun compass was invented by a man whose name, I'm ashamed to say, I can't remember, because near Edenbridge in Kent is a little village called Cowden, a few miles south, and he lived in Cowden, and I cannot bring his name to mind, but he invented the sun compass by which, if you were told to proceed on a certain bearing, you could relate that bearing to the angle of the sun as on a sundial, and making some allowance for time change, you could pretty accurately follow a compass bearing. At night, of course, you could see the Southern Cross, the Southern Hemisphere, and you learned to do a little bit of reading by the stars. But finding your way about, and that's why, except for the relatively few static battles, the mobile warfare of the Western Desert was chaotic, and the troops of the opposing side got mixed up to an extraordinary degree. And one was as surprised as the other. Well, the military situation was fairly desperate. We trained very, very hard, and one brigade one brigade, the 23rd Armored Brigade of ours, was sent more or less straight into the desert. And it was always said, through a major mistake of map reading, they were decimated by the Germans. We ourselves did have 1 month near Ismailia training, very hard indeed, and then we were sent up to the desert. In the very first few days of August 1942.
Could you tell me something about the training in Ismailia that you were doing?
Well, the training there was chiefly navigational training, learning to find your way about the desert.
Using the sun,
yes.
The sun compass.
Basic military training. We were in the same vehicles. The armoured cars had followed us in a slow convoy round the Cape. And they arrived and they had to be made desert worthy. And equipped, for instance, with sand channels on the front of the armoured car. You have to remember that the desert, first of all, it was mostly dust and not sand. Therefore, when it did rain, it was very sticky and difficult. Quite a lot of the desert was rock, overlain by a layer of desert sand, as it was called. But there was rock outcrop every now and again. And a lot of the desert was what we call soft sand. That was deep sand. And the armoured cars simply sunk up to their axles. Hmm. And they were very difficult to get out onto hard ground when you could find it. These sand channels were 6 feet long, channels of iron, perforated iron. And when you got stuck, you had to get out, push the sand channel under the front wheels, measure the 6 feet of the sand channel and do the same again. And that in the blazing heat of the desert. It's a very, very unpleasant activity.
Mm. Were you... was your ship amongst the first of the troop ships to arrive? Had there been many before?
Well, there were quite a lot of troops in the Middle East. We had had desert-worthy troops out there, but a few regiments throughout the peacetime between the two wars. And before the Germans got control of the Mediterranean, quite a lot of ships did go, but we were one of the first convoys to go around the Cape and make the long journey. Now, at this time, the British were fighting what is often called the First Battle of Alamein. That was a defensive battle that was fought by General Auchinleck to stop the Germans at Alamein. The decision was taken, rightly, not to fight, as British politicians were urging the Desert Army to do, to hold the Germans at Tobruk, but to come back all the way to Alamein, because at Alamein there's only a 30 to 40 mile gap. You had the Mediterranean looking east, you had, as we were doing, you had the Mediterranean Sea on your left, and you had the impassable Katara Depression on your right. And the defensive line was this short distance of 30 or 40 miles, whereas the gaps in the area of Tobruk were of the order of 150 miles. Whether it was a conscious decision or whether it was dictated by events, the fact that the Germans were being so successful, I expect it, like many things in life, it was a mixture of the two. But it was a good decision. And the defensive battle, I say now called First Alamein, which we hadn't taken part in, that took place in July, was very critical. We managed, the English, the British Empire, indeed, Alamein was the last time the troops of almost, I think, the whole of the British Empire. There were troops from Australia, from New Zealand, from many African countries, and almost, I'm from India, of course, the Indian 4th Indian Division. We're all taking part in this ferocious fighting that was to take place at Alamut. Anyhow, the defensive battle was over by the time we got there. But it was known that Rommel's intention was to get to the Delta, to get to Alexandria and Cairo, where they would have access to the Middle Eastern oil, which was vital to our war effort, and they could get in what was then called Mesopotamia, and today, in 2005, is called Iraq. So, we had to train quickly in the desert itself, get accustomed to it, get accustomed to living out of your armoured car. An armoured car normally contains three people: a driver, a commander, and a gunner who was also the driver operator. They had 1 gallon of water a day in the fighting, and that had to do to wash yourself, to wash your clothes, to keep the radiator, the vehicle topped up, and of course for drinking water. You got 1.5 gallons when you were static at Alamein, but it became 1 gallon as soon as you moved away into moving into mobile warfare.
So you said you were actually living on the...
You lived on the vehicle. You had a cooker. Most of the cooking was done by pouring some petrol into the sand and setting it alight. But you had a gas cooker. The driver normally did the cooking. In the desert, we, on the whole, were very well supplied, but we were supplied with very basic food. Bully beef, tinned corned beef, and hard biscuits. And a certain amount of tinned food. I remember tinned bacon, tinned tomatoes, tinned porridge, but no fresh food. Occasionally an Egyptian onion, I think, but practically no fresh food. But people were remarkably fit. The desert, the sun rose at 8 o'clock in the morning pretty predictably. By midday, the temperature was over 100, perhaps 90-something on the coast, but going up to 120, 130 deeper into the desert, further down south in the desert. And it was very, very uncomfortable, very difficult between 12 o'clock and 2, half past 2. But then it started to cool. And after 8 hours, that 4, 4:30, it was getting distinctly cooler and was really quite pleasant. The awful disadvantage was, of course, the flies. You pour a cup of tea, it would be black with flies within minutes. And, as I say, the very burdensome heat at midday. Well, for once, the British made the right decisions for the coming defensive battles, defensive as far as we were concerned, which was Rommel's last but one attempt to get to the Nile Delta. It was called by us, it's called now Second Alamein, we called it Alam Halfa, because Alam Halfa was a strip of raised ground. And the British, one has to remember that throughout the desert war, we were under-armoured and under-armed. Our tanks weren't well enough armoured, and they did not carry a decent heavy gun. We all had, the armoured cars had, nearly all the tanks had the 6-pounder gun. The Germans had the 88mm. The 88mm gun was originally an anti-aircraft gun. And somebody said one day, what about using that as a ground weapon? And it was devastating. I think it was, so far as ground troops were concerned, the outstanding piece of gun equipment for the whole of the Western War. So, for the battle of alum helper. A lot of our tanks were dug in, and so that we had a good anti-tank gun, the 6-pounder by then, and the 6-pounders were dug in. The question was, would Rommel try to go along the coast road up on the north, or would he climb a right hook, as we called it, at the extremity of the Alamein line? For many reasons, he was believed to be going round the south, and he did, and he motored straight onto our dug-in guns, and he suffered very severe casualties, as we did. They fought desperately hard. They were within sight of, as they saw it, of Alexandria, but three or four days, ferocious battle. Now, we in armoured cars, in that sort of static battle, armoured cars have a very limited role. We had an important but very unpleasant job of observing, getting into position to observe the minefield gaps. See, both sides mined the desert, and only they knew the ways through. But they had to go slowly through the minefield gap and were easily identifiable. And the critical thing for our guns and tanks further back, awaiting the German advance, was to know when they were coming and what was coming. That information, the armoured car regiments, ours and others, were responsible for sending back to higher formations. And it was done very successfully. We had one of the nicest communications of the war from the general commanding the corps in our first sight of desert warfare, I remember afterwards. So there was a stalemate. Winston Churchill, of course, and politicians in Britain were urging that something should be done, and so they had brought in Montgomery. Montgomery was actually nominally in charge. He was in charge of the battle I've been talking about, Alam Halfa, but the decisions were taken before he arrived as to disposition of the British troops. They had been taken by Auchinleck, so it's true to say it was Auchinleck's plan, although it was operated by Montgomery. And from then on, the Western Desert troops were commanded by General Montgomery. I'm sure the history books can tell you more than I can about his contribution, but he was certainly a breath of fresh air. The British troops who'd been battling for two years up and down the desert were very tired, and their morale was rather low, chiefly because of this inadequacy of our equipment compared to the Germans. Our tanks and gunnery and so on are so inferior to theirs. But so Montgomery did beam, and of course he was a great publicist, and he did cheer everyone up. Now, the great battle of Alamein was to start, and everyone knows the 1,000 guns opened up on the night of the 23rd of October 1942. Initially, we were down south, creating a diversion. We were in the 7th Army, famous 7th Armoured Division, the Desert Rats. They were held there to make the Germans think that was where the main British strength was. And of course, this, for once, for a long time, was, as far as we were concerned, an off-air battle. I remember seeing there for the first time, I was with my commanding officer at daybreak. The army always stood to at the break of dawn. And he said, just look over there, and I saw a whole line of our tanks moving behind us, but across the battlefield. And he said to me, my colonel said, what did Lord Allenby said, what's strange about those tanks? I said, I don't know. He said, well, what are they? I said, well, I don't know they're there. Are they these new Shermans? I don't know. He said, no, but what's very peculiar about them? I said, I'm sorry, I don't know. He said, they make no noise. They've got no tracks. They are lorries with canvas tanks built over them. to look like tanks, and there was a whole division of these phantom tanks. Experiments have been conducted post-war from the air to try and distinguish